Why not become a My Perfect Console Patreon supporter? For just $5 a month, you will get your episodes early and ad-free. You'll get access to the members-only My Perfect Console community lounge. You'll receive guest announcements exclusively before the general public. You can pitch questions to future guests, download bonus episodes in which guests answer those questions, and vote in the annual My Perfect Console Best Console of the Year knockout competition, coming later in 2023. Hop along to www.patreon.com/myperfectconsole and become a supporter.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a writer and narrative designer for independence and blockbuster video games. Born in London, she studied English literature at Kingston University, then completed her postgrad in journalism. She worked as a freelance writer, contributing to The Guardian and the BBC, often covering video games and the lack of representation of people of colour within the industry. In 2014, she took a course titled Writing for Games, which resulted in Before I Forget, an affecting game in which you play as a dementia sufferer. In 2020, she joined Massive Entertainment, the Swedish developer of The Division, to work as a senior narrative designer on an open-world action-adventure game based on the James Cameron-directed Avatar films. She is also writing Windrush Tales, a narrative video game about the triumphs and tribulations of two Caribbean immigrants to post-war Britain in the world's first Windrush-themed video game. Welcome, Shela Ramanan.
Hi, sounds really impressive.
It is really impressive. Were there any mistakes in that, or am I okay?
No, it was great. I'm like, wow, she sounds cool.
So I wanted to start just by, I guess, jumping off the deep end a bit. I wanted to ask you about your Windrush project, because we happen to be speaking on Windrush Day in the UK, and I was actually watching the BBC One's main 6 o'clock news last night. And there was a long story with fresh details about the scandal. So it's, you know, very much an ongoing thing in the news, certainly in Britain. Could you just explain to listeners who perhaps don't know what it refers to? What Windrush means? What does it refer to?
Yeah, so the Windrush, which became known as the Windrush Generation, was a period of immigration from the Caribbean to the UK between 1948 and, I think, like about 1972. So over several decades. So post-war Britain was pretty much on its knees and had labour shortage and invited people from across the Commonwealth. But there was a big response from the Caribbean. So they invited people, British citizens, citizens of the former empire, which was then the Commonwealth. And I think they expected Canadians and Australians to answer the call. And they got people from Nigeria and the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent. And they weren't quite expecting that.
Am I right thinking people were coming to sort of help rebuild London after the Blitz, at least in the early years?
Yeah, so it was, you know, these people who came at that time were foundationals in building the NHS, the rail system, so British Rail, the bus systems, London Bus, and, you know, outside London as well, you know, people were in Bristol, Liverpool, Birmingham, and, you know, sort of foundational part of those infrastructures that were created in post-war Britain.
And the scandal part all started in about 2018, and this was to do with the Home Office deporting basically people who had come as part of the Windrush generation, which refers to the name of the ship, the first ship that came, doesn't it? The Empire Windrush. And claiming that these individuals were not actually British citizens and they had to return home. Is that sort of the long and short of it?
Yeah, I mean, the Windrush scandal was just the exposure of, you know, 10 years of a hostile immigration policy that, you know, it had been hidden that it was affecting people who came during the Windrush immigration period. You know, people thought, and it was terrible no matter who it was affecting, any immigrants that it was impacting. But, you know, the fact that they, under this hostile immigration policy, which was started by Theresa May back when she was Home Secretary, and then the scandal was unveiled when she was Prime Minister. The fact that, you know, these people were invited, they were British citizens, and some of their papers had been destroyed whilst Theresa May was Home Secretary. So they couldn't actually prove the things that they were suddenly asked to prove. People couldn't access the NHS. People died, literally died because of...
These are in older individuals as well, aren't they? So it's people sort of in the 60s, 70s and 80s.
Typically, but also younger as well, because some people who came as babies and then were asked for papers, because, you know, people were coming right up until, you know, 1970, 71, so they could be relatively young too.
You're a British Caribbean woman. How does the story relate to you and your story in any way?
So my dad and my uncle, I suppose, would be considered part of the Windrush generation. They both came to London in the 50s and studied. They went to university and, you know, were just part of the early British Caribbean community. Yeah, I went to school in Notting Hill Gate, so I suppose, that was kind of a hub. You know, we still have Carnival there, and, you know, it's a hub of Caribbean community in the early days. It's different now because it's kind of gentrified. But, you know, back then that was the soundtrack to my childhood, was sort of like reggae music drifting over the air across the streets and stuff like that in London at that time.
Yeah. You've chosen to make a video game about this rather difficult topic. I think, you know, there can be some trepidation from game developers when it comes to representing these quite traumatic historical events in video games, because I suppose partly because games are interactive and there's a risk perhaps that you imply to players that if they make the right decisions or whatever, then perhaps they could change the fate of the characters, which I suppose, you know, if you're making a game about the Holocaust, for example, could be a bit problematic. So, you know, how are you getting around some of that difficult terrain in your game, which I'm sure you've considered deeply?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the story of people who came over isn't a story of trauma. It's a story of hope and, you know, at least at the beginning, you know, and it's like a sense of belonging because they were British, they were going to the mother country, and, you know, there were sort of like hopes and dreams there. And yes, they were met with hostility and there were lots of hardships and things, but there was also, you know, like the building of community and, you know, literally sort of changed the face of Britain, you know, being sort of those foundational part of that sort of building of the NHS. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of sense of pride. So it's kind of finding, because like the just that the everyday of people is, even when they are living in traumatic circumstances, isn't just like minute to minute trauma. There's always human connection and kindnesses like woven into that. So I think it's about sort of like unpacking who our characters are, what matters to them, and what their hopes and dreams are, and then how the backdrop of that experience flavors and adds texture to that journey.
Yeah, super interesting. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, your previous game was about dementia. You're sort of, it is very delicately presented game about degenerative illness, but obviously that is also a fraught topic. What attracts you to these quite big subjects that maybe other developers might shy away from, do you think?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why I take on these things. Neither of us have personal experience of dementia, fortunately for us. So Claire Morwood is my co-developer at Threefold Games. But yeah, I guess I had that as a writer. You know, I was writing prose before I started writing games, and I had that sort of like, well, a Nolan-esque preoccupation with memory and what it means, like what happens when someone loses their memory. Are they a different person? Who do they become? You know, because there's still a person there. And so, yeah, it was just based on that sort of curiosity. And also it was very topical at the time. And I guess I am interested in, we as both as Threefold Games are interested in why games don't tell these stories. Mm. You know, they are both everyday and dramatic and filled with conflict. And yes, that's a good place to tell a story.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's about sort of like asking the question, like, what is a game and why can't games do this as well as films and books and TV?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we will get into this later, but you do straddle these two worlds in that you are making, you know, quite serious independent games with your development partner. And then you're also working on, like, you know, the biggest of big blockbuster entertainment. It doesn't get much bigger than Avatar, does it?
It doesn't.
And when before we started recording, you were just saying you've just come from like a voice recording session. What does it feel like to occupy those two worlds? And some of the things that you were talking about just there that you think games should be doing in the same way that books and films do, are you able to introduce any of that to the world of Avatar?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm really lucky in terms of my narrative team and my narrative director, and her storytelling sensibilities definitely is, she's all about games can have good writing and should have good writing and should have storytelling grounded in good characters with believable motivations and needs and goals in order to drive plot and story and elevate the gameplay experience. So I'm lucky in that respect.
Well, it seems like a good moment to come to the premise of the podcast. I've asked you to pick the five video games you'd like to install in your very own perfect, ideal, fictional games machine. Your first game is from 1994, and I think it fits some of these criteria that you're describing, directed by a previous guest of the show. Do you want to tell us, what is this this game and why have you chosen it?
It is Beneath a Steel Sky. It's It's not the first game I ever played, but it's the first game I really wanted to play and was invested in. I didn't play games as a kid because it was just something that we couldn't afford. It was just like a thing that other people had in their houses when I went round to people's houses. Played Super Mario Brothers when I was with my Grenadian cousins in Grenada one summer. So yeah, I was just sitting on the gorgeous island of Grenada inside playing Mario Brothers, just speed running that. And it was fun, but it didn't really engage me beyond that moment, that cool moment with my cousins. It didn't make me think like, oh, I want one of those machines, or, you know, I suddenly need to play. It was fun and that was it. And then, you know, sometimes I'd go around to a friend's house and they'd have a computer and get this huge book out, and we'd have to spend an hour just like plugging code in and stuff. And I was just like, and the sort of the trials and tribulations to get to the point of a game that might actually just crash as soon as you tried to load it. I was just like, this is the kind of
painful
entertainment option. So yeah, so those were my experiences of games up to this point until I went to uni. And then there were some kids who like brought machines with them, and my friend Scouser had an Amiga, and we used to just like in the halls of residence just hang out of like getting stoned till like dawn, or whatever. I don't know if we're allowed drug references on your podcast, but you can edit that out if it's not 420 friendly.
It's fine.
I think
so. You'd be playing Beneath the Steel Sky sort of during these sessions.
So we'd play it together basically as it was a group, a very much a sort of communal experience. You know, it was like we didn't have the internet then, so if we got stuck, we'd get stuck on a thing, we'd all be trying to figure it out. And the Scouser had this guy called Martin who'd like finished the game. So he wasn't at uni. I don't know what Martin did, but he was just like Scouser's mate. And then we'd be like, phone Martin.
He was like the helpline.
Yeah. So we'd like literally like he'd go downstairs to the phone in the hall, student halls, phone Martin to ask him to get us this bit we'd got stuck on.
That's incredible. So just describe the game. So it's made by Revolution Software, directed by Charles Cecil, and it's a sort of adventure game, isn't it? But steampunky, is that right?
Yeah, sort of like it's cyberpunk, I would say. Yeah, I guess maybe it does have a little bit of steampunk. Yeah, it's kind of a cyberpunk, I guess, sort of Blade Runner-y type thing, but it's still quite industrial. But it has British, so it's a point and click. And it has those obtuse puzzles where, you know, like put jam on the doorknob to attract the bees or whatever it is. It's funny. I guess me being I was doing a literature degree then and interested in story, it immediately engaged me more than Mario did for those reasons. You know, like the dialogue was really funny and it looked amazing at the time. I can't believe that you can just like play it on your phone or like play it on a postage stamp now, but it looked incredible at the time. And, you know, had this helicopter car crash. So it's like this city, sort of cyberpunk cityscape, and there's helicopter crashes at the beginning and you're on a ledge in this. And you've got a cool coat on, of course, because you have to, when it's cyberpunk, you have to have like a cool coat.
Yep.
But then it has like this character who's a northern factory mill owner sort of type of character who's just like, nay lads and stuff like this. And so it has that sort of Revolution Software humor. Yeah, it was just a really sort of formative experience for me, because then I didn't even know what a point and click was or what the genre was. I was just, I want to play another game like that. So at some point I borrowed Scouser's Amiga when we moved out of halls, and he left it.
Was Scouser his name or where he was from?
No, he was called Paul, but he was just like, he was just from Liverpool and this was the South. So
just the imagination of students.
I know, right? So he lent me his Amiga and I played it. Yeah, so it's the first game I played alone from start to finish, you know, myself.
Right. Oh, fantastic. So let's wind the clock back a little bit. You've talked a little bit about growing up in South London, but did you live in Notting Hill?
No, we lived in Holland
Park.
You
went to school there?
Yeah, I went to, so it's just like a walk up the road, basically, yeah.
Yeah, right, nice, all around Portobello Road and all of that.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah, Shepherd's Bush.
Great part of London.
Stuff. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
And did you have siblings?
Yeah, I have an older brother who's like 7.5 years older than me.
Right, okay. And what were your parents up to at that time? Were they both around?
So my dad, so my brother and I have different fathers. So his father was a poet, jazz musician from St. Vincent, and my dad was a civil engineer. So he was around for a little bit of my childhood until about 4, and then he moved back to the Caribbean, so then he was in Tobago. So yeah, it was just my brother and my mum, basically. That's our family unit. And then my relationship with my dad for a really long time was just letters, basically. Yeah.
And did you mentioned going to Grenada. Did you go to the Caribbean often?
I didn't. So like, yeah, so it was, my relationship with him was letters until I was about 14. And then he said, I wonder if he was waiting until I was like a certain age and could fly alone or something like that. I think he wrote the letter, like I wrote a separate letter to my mum inside my letter. And it was like, does Shella want to come to Washington, D.C. to meet her cousins and then we'll go to Grenada? And I didn't even know I had cousins at that point. So this was like really exciting because, yeah, I had this whole black side of the family that I just never saw. My mum is white, Scottish. I didn't have that kind of black influence in my home, basically. So this was kind of really cool. Like I had like American cousins. It's like, wow.
Yeah. How did you feel when you got off the plane?
So I'd never been on a plane before. Yeah, it was a whole adventure. And then, my uncle and aunt picked me up in D.C. We flew out to meet my dad. So yeah, the first people I met were my uncle and aunt, and then my cousins had like drawn a little banner to say like, welcome, Shella, or something like that. It was very cute. And that was amazing because it was just like, being a sort of young teenager in America, I was like super cool because it's just like being in a movie, like their houses are bigger and everything's cooler. And, you know, they're a sort of affluent middle class black family. So they had like a swimming pool.
Wow.
You know, it was just like, I was just like, what?
That's such an intense few days though for you, because you're getting on a plane for the first time, going to America for the first time, meeting all this family you've never met before, and then flying to meet your dad who you haven't seen for years.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. Yeah. So then we flew to Grenada all together to meet my dad. And yeah, so that was, because all I had was like a photo of him and I'm sitting on his lap when I'm like 4 or something. But he was a very charming man. He's everyone's favorite uncle. All my cousins were like, Uncle Norris is the best uncle. So, because he's funny and mischievous and, you know, all the things that I guess a good uncle should be.
Yeah. And you said that, you know, games weren't part of your childhood, but I'm guessing that books were, because you go on to do this English lit degree. So, yeah, what role did literature have for you, or, you know, novels or whatever when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I was just reading constantly. So my brother's 7.5 years older than me, so he wasn't really a playmate. You know, he was always like studying for exams and things, boring stuff like that. And so yeah, I was just like a highly romantic child with a capital R, kind of like lost in books, loved stuff like Jane Eyre and, you know, like watching the old movie versions of that with Orson Welles, and voracious reader. And then yeah, just like reading everything, basically.
Did you want to be a novelist at that point?
I did, yeah. I was always trying to write crappy stories. Yeah, I did always want to write.
Okay, let's come to your second game then, Shella. So tell us about this one. This is from the year 2000. A little different from your first choice, I'd say. What's this game?
This is Tony Hawk's Skateboarding, or Pro Skateboarding, as it's called in the US.
Hey,
down, down, gonna beat up the runs. You're gonna drive, I'll bring the beer. It's a late, late ship, no one to fear.
As it says on the tin, it's a skateboarding game. This game basically just captured the zeitgeist. I think for me, it was like a golden era of games. PlayStation was just this phenomenon that came to be. You know, it was like, you know, it was, what was that, like a 10-year console generation or something like that. You know, it was incredible. You know, there was sort of rave culture going on in the UK at the time. And, you know, this sort of like, all the music was good at the time. And Tony Hawk's just kind of captured that energy of the period.
Yeah, it was all licensed music, wasn't it, from bands. And
So it was all like Less Than Jake and Blink-182 and, yeah, just amazing soundtrack. And basically, I had a friend from uni who was in the games industry. I think he was in sales at that time. So he wasn't working for a publisher yet. He went on to work for Konami, but I think he was just a sales rep, and he'd come home with like demos and stuff like that sometimes, or like come round. And he came round one day and he dropped this demo disc, and it was for Tony Hawk's and Another Drug Rapper. So I was getting stoned again with friends. There were certain friends who'd like come round, this couple who'd come round, get stoned, and we were just obsessed with this demo. We'd like, they'd come round every night and we'd just play the frick out of this demo. And it was just like, I think it was like one level, maybe two levels at most.
Right.
We played that for like literally months. In fact, like my mate came round and we were playing it. He's like, "You still playing that demo?"
I'll buy you the full game at this point.
Yeah, we just like played it to death. But, and, you know, just like anticipating this game, because we'd just put on dance music or something, because we were always going clubbing and going raving and stuff. So we just sometimes put our own music on it and just like get stoned and like get in the zone and just be doing the half pipe to this like track. And just, yeah, and it was just great. It was a really good time.
It's a game that really encourages flow states, doesn't it? Because it's not very, I would say it's not a realistic interpretation of skateboarding. You've got like Tony Hawk is like, you know, doing insane moves all the time, and you're just hammering the buttons that he's doing, linking together tricks and all of that. And when you, it's such a great feeling, isn't it? When you're like switching from you know, doing a spin and then landing and doing a
360 Christ air was the ultimate move, step down circle.
I love it. Still remember the buttons.
I just remember like my friends going up down circle. I was like, I'm trying. And the clock ticks down as well, because I think you only had certain modes on the demo. We just loved that game so much.
Right, let's get back to your story then. So you're in Kingston and doing your English Literature degree and discovering point and click adventure games. What's the plan at this point then? So did you want to graduate and become a journalist, or were you going to try and write books, or what was the plan?
Yeah, the plan was to be a journalist. Yeah, anything in a sort of creative media field, I guess, that I could get a job in.
How smooth was that? Because it can be quite difficult starting out, particularly in the UK.
Yeah, no, it was tough. Yeah, I didn't go straight from uni into a journalist position. I was unemployed for almost a year. Yeah, I remember my course or my department secretary or whatever phoned up, because I guess they do this survey of graduates. It was the most depressing phone call of my life, because she phoned up, she was like, "Hi, Shella." She's like, "I'm just phoning around everyone to see what you're doing." And I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm unemployed, thanks for that."
I could do the cry stare really well sometimes.
I did have a job by then, let it be noted. So I got a job at an inline skate distributor, actually, funnily enough.
Really?
And it was just, I was just a receptionist, and I was there for quite a long time just applying for stuff. And that's when I decided to, yeah, so I was always doing, there was like a Vogue journalist competition and stuff like that. So I like apply for stuff like that, like as if anyone called Shella Ramanan was going to get a job at Vogue at that time. Just, I'd have had to be amazing and I wasn't. So yeah, so I did, yeah, this post-grad course that I found, yeah, there were lots of kind of indie magazines at the time then, you know, sort of like cool culture magazines doing street culture type things, kicking around. So I saw it in the back of one of those that I liked reading. And yeah, it was just advertising for, yeah, a journalism degree that I was like, that sounds cool. And you could get funding. It had some sort of like grant funding scheme attached to it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did that. And then, I was like, okay, I need to specialize in some, you know, what sort of field of journalism do I want to go into? And I thought about film, but film felt like, because it was all like Barry Norman and, you know, it was just like felt like white guy, like old white guys kind of thing. And I don't know why I thought video games wasn't that. I guess, I don't know, the naivete was just...
Well, I suppose it was young white guys at least rather than old ones.
Yeah, so, and I guess, yeah, it just seemed a bit more kind of... street and like less established, I think.
Might be opportunities there.
Yeah, exactly. I guess I didn't I didn't move through the world thinking, well, that's going to be closed to me because I'm a woman and I'm black, you know. I just thought, yeah, this is like young and vibrant and I'm interested in it and I could write about that.
Please.
You know, my friend who was at, by this point, he was at Konami, and so, you know, I'd hear about inside the industry and it was really interesting hearing about. Yes, I wasn't just interested in, oh, what's the latest game? And I liked the movements, like the way that people like move around the industry. And then this person who was on this team for, you know, Beneath Steel Sky, for instance, and now they've moved to this publisher or this developer over here. And so there's this like through line, this sort of like rock family tree type thing. But for video games, I found that really interesting.
Yeah, and I guess through your friends, you have a slight sort of peek behind the curtain, don't you?
Yeah,
and lots
exactly.
of other people don't have. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
And it does work out and you start getting you know, commissions and all sorts of lovely places. What was it that made you take this course then in writing for games in 2014 or around then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the course was actually at the Arvon Foundation. So it was Hebden Bridge. I was seriously pursuing trying to write a novel, basically. So I was running a writing group. Yeah, I'd been going like, even so I moved out of London. Even when I was in London, I'd go to writing evening classes and things like that. And then I moved to Somerset, and yeah, so I did that again. So I was always at writing classes or in some sort of writing group. And then I decided to create my own because I wanted to curate the people who were in my writing group so that they would be good writers.
You know, diligent selection process.
Yeah. So like, I just like, as long as they can write and are good at giving feedback, because otherwise you're kind of wasting your time because you're not honing your craft. And yeah, I just wanted to be surrounded by people who were good and were kind of serious about it. So I was writing this novel about a man with no memory. I just saw it, this ad for the Arvon Foundation course, that it was like a light bulb moment, because the only people that wrote video games at that point were Rihanna Pratchett.
Yes. Terry Pratchett's daughter who wrote Tomb Raider, didn't she?
Yeah. So it was just like, you know, it was like these sort of lofty people who belonged to a different world than I was in. You know, I had no idea how they got there. And then I was just like, wow, there's like a course of writing for games. I know games and I like writing. That's a thing I could do. So yeah, I went on that week long retreat, and it's not an overstatement to say it changed my life, basically.
Well, let's pause then. We'll come back to it. But for now, let's come to your third game for your console then. So this is from 2004. Got to admit, I was a little surprised by this choice. Tell us what it is and why you love it.
So it's City of Heroes, which is an MMORPG. I saw recently someone saying, can MMOs just die?
Yeah, so by MMOs, for any, everyone knows what they are, but yeah, we mean things like World of Warcraft, Final Fantasy 14, always on, you know, tons of people around the world.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
We'd all join up and adventure together. And this is like a sort of, it's not Marvel, but it's sort of like Marvel, right?
Yeah.
Or is it Marvel?
No, it's not Marvel. It was pre-all MCU, which was the lovely thing about it. It's basically you get to build a superhero. And there's this sort of superhero city that's full of statues to I think it's called Liberty City. And it basically looks like skyscrapers and clean blue skies and everything like that. Yeah, it has a city hall, which is, you know, where all the heroes register. You get to be a superhero, as though I was, part of my childhood was Marvel Comics. Thanks to my brother, though my brother made me the nerd I am today. Yeah, I used to pour over his comic collection. Yeah, I loved superheroes and like draw them. At one point, I wanted to be a comic book artist. Yeah, so when this came out, I'd never played an MMO before because it was kind of intimidating because it had its own language and, you know, you're playing with other people and I was very much a sort of solo player. But the lure of being a superhero was just too much for me.
Do you remember what your character looked like? What attributes they had?
So I had a beta character. So I signed up for the beta. I actually bought a new PC because my laptop wouldn't run it. So I bought a new PC just to play as superheroes. And like immediately that day. So I played the beta and I can't remember the name of my character in the beta, but she was named after some like very specific Saharan wind or something like that.
Spot the English lit degree.
And then but my main character was Seraph. So she was very classic Marvel. So she had the leotard, she had the boots, and she had the like gold belt type thing, big hair. It was like sometimes it was pink, but I guess I could respec it, and sometimes it was blue. But she had like horns. And the cool thing about City of Heroes is you could write your origin story.
Oh, nice.
And then when people were running around in the world, they could click on you and read your story. And so sometimes you'd be running along and someone would like tell at you and be like, cool bio and stuff like that. Yeah, it was really cool. I love that game so much.
Oh, that's amazing. It's like sort of proto writing for games, isn't it, I suppose, that you were doing there, writing your character's backstory.
Yeah.
Did you ever find a little group that you started playing with, or were you always a solo player?
No. It's like, so when I entered that world as a superhero, I was fully in it. This person that who was called Demonica, who had the same horns as me.
You were rivals, were you?
No, we were like, cool, you must be from the same. So we used to hang out and we're still like friends, because sometimes he sends me a happy birthday and stuff like that. And yeah, we've never met in real life, but we used to hang out a lot in City of Heroes. So yeah, I used to meet up with people like every night. And I'm not a very good MMO player because I can't be asked with, once you get to a certain level, you have to like read all the forums and stuff to get your build right. And I just can't be bothered with that. I just want to do cool stuff in the world. So yeah, so at a certain point, I was always meeting new people because people would just start leveling up through the higher levels really quickly. I was kind of like grinding slowly because I couldn't be bothered to... Because I said to Demonica, I was like, how have you like just like gained 8 levels? And it's like, oh yeah, you like here's like this forum, and I was just like, no.
I thought I'm just going to change the colour of my hair. I think,
yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Okay, City of Heroes. Yes, let's go back to this. So you've done this course. You've been working on a novel about forgetting, mm-hmm. and then you sort of have this light bulb moment of, what if I maybe try that in Switch medium and move into a video game? Why did you decide to cast the protagonist as an Indian woman?
Yeah, just because I was tired of not seeing any Indian people in video games, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just... it's a short answer, but that's what it is.
Yeah, fair enough. And so how long did it take you to find, because you're not a programmer, so you needed to pair up with someone. How did that work? Was that someone that you met on this writing course, or how did you get paired up?
Yeah, so when I went to the Avon Foundation, there was one other woman on the course called Constance Plurio, and she lived in Bristol. So we both had gone from the southwest of England all the way up to Hebden Bridge, which is very far north in Yorkshire, and to meet each other. And she had a games hub for women, like a games group. And she's, very sort of organizes a lot of stuff. So, she was one of the people I met there. And when I went back home and was, sort of focusing on writing a game in ink, I think I was just sort of pursuing that. And I did a workshop in Bristol on writing for radio. And she was hosting a game jam that same autumn. So I signed up for that. And then I got cold feet and told her, I was like, I don't think I can do this. And she's like, don't be so bloody ridiculous. So I went to this game jam absolutely terrified because, I'm not a programmer, I'm not technical, and, I was sort of worried they'd just laugh me out of the room. But it was an XX Plus game jam, so it was for women and non-binary and gender fluid people. So that was less intimidating because I had thought about game jams before, but I'd always been kind of intimidated by it. So I went there and it was quite terrible because it was almost like, in PE class when people are choosing teams and
you had to line up.
We didn't have to line up, but people were milling and sort of like hooking up with people.
Pairing off.
Yeah,
always
like speed dating. It was like something terrible. And then Constance actually was like, just like paired me up with Claire and another woman. And so Claire Morwood, and that was where Threefold Games was born, basically. Claire's a programmer, artist, and she's just super talented and does lots of things.
How quickly at that game jam did you suggest your idea then? Because I know in those early moments when everyone's sort of saying, well, what are we going to do then? Like, it could be, you're quite vulnerable, aren't you, when you put your idea on the table?
Yeah, I think from going to the Avon Foundation thing, I kind of prepared a little bit. Because there I hadn't been to anything like that for ages. And of course, they say, oh, now write a scene that's like this. And like, we'll give you like 10 minutes. And my brain just went blank. I was just like, yeah. And everybody else is like furiously scribbling. It was just like being in an exam or something where you've just like forgotten everything. So like before I went to the radio retreat workshop, I kind of like had a look through my notebook of ideas just to see, if they asked me for like to write something in 5 minutes, I had some seeds in my head. And I also did this for the game jam. So I kind of flicked through my notebook to have a look at some things. And there was woman with dementia was just like one of the things. And so it kind of, that was in my head. And we threw around like a bunch of ideas at the time. So the theme was borders. Trump was threatening to build a wall at the time. There was a Syrian refugee crisis going on. So there was, you know, which is presumably why they chose the theme borders, because, you know, it was very topical at the time. So we kind of thought about along those kinds of lines. And then, like, Sharon, the other person who was in our group, she was like, oh, it's like a bit depressing, isn't it? Like, because we were like, oh, it's like refugees or something. Or it's like, could be about Trump's wall. And she was like, oh, it's like. And so we were sort of, you know, just. There was a little bit of push and pull there, like pulling in different directions. And then I just said, I was like, oh, we're about that. I'd have this idea for a woman with dementia. And I was like, maybe it could be about psychological borders rather than physical ones or geopolitical ones. Yeah, that just instantly, Claire just picked up on that and just like bounced off it. And then we were like, oh, yeah, because then she could be in a house. And then like Sharon had ideas and stuff as well about music because she was a audio person. And yeah, it was instantly we had a person, like a theme, a setting, because we were like, well, she could be in a house then. And, you know, because we've only got so much time to make this thing. So we have constraints there.
Yes. Useful constraints. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a good moment, isn't it? When you're collaborating with someone and then suddenly someone suggests something and everyone is like, yes, that's the thing. Let's go.
Yeah.
Right, let's come to your fourth game then, which is from 2016. Tell us about this one.
This is Virginia. So this game is, yes, it was interesting because we've come to exactly the right point in terms of talking about the development of Before I Forget. And this was really one of my reference points. So Virginia is a X-Files meets Twin Peaks is the kind of like tagline for it. Yeah, so it has this kind of weird X-Files vibe, and there's two FBI agents. They're both black women, so it has these two black female protagonists. It's told with no dialogue, but the storytelling is really impeccable. And then it has the
very stylish, isn't it? Like a prestige TV series.
Yes, it is
very, very well directed angle, camera angles, and all of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it is. It's really beautiful, and yeah, so it has this kind of mystery to it. So it is basically the Fox Mulder is a black woman and she's in the basement and it sort of reveals her backstory. I think she's the daughter of a black activist, basically, which is why she's kind of been sort of sidelined. So, you know, through association with this person, she's not desirable. So she's in the basement, just like with weird, you know, dealing with the odd cases, basically, which I think is such a cool idea.
Yeah, such a cool idea.
Yeah, it's like a much more interesting Fox Mulder.
Yeah. And so this was like a real reference point for you when working on Before
It wears its references on its sleeve, which I like about it. So it, you know, pays homage to 30 Flights of Loving, is this game that, you know, has these very blocky sort of polygon style graphics. But it's extremely cinematic in its energy. So it's this kind of...
Yes.
Is it kind of like a heist type storyline? I can't remember exactly what's going on in it, but it's got this kind of Quentin Tarantino kind of vibe.
Yes,
to it.
It's a very short game, isn't it? By Brendan Chung, who actually I've recorded an episode with, so that'll be coming out soon.
Oh, great.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's a very, very influential game, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really influential. And Virginia, you know, actually, you know, mentions it in its credits. And so, yeah, it also uses... So what I really like about 30 Flights, the way that it uses cinematic techniques, like I know we're supposed to be talking about Virginia, but yeah, no, one leads to the other, is that it's cinematic pretensions or sort of references, you know, like something like Naughty Dog is trying to be a film, whereas this 30 Flights is very much a game, and so is Virginia in, you know, its presentation. 30 Flights is, you know, this polygon, you know, you're not going to get a film that looks like that, really. Yeah, so I really like the way that that game uses the jump cuts, and then Virginia does that too, and creates this kind of surreal, this Lynchian kind of vibe, which it was a big influence on us, and basically because we were dealing with a woman who would have lucid moments and then would have, you know, like full flashbacks to other points in time. And we were dealing with this kind of very controlled space of her house. And, you know, we needed ways to guide the player or sometimes take power away from the player. Because that's, you know, one of the core things that we were playing with was the sort of power fantasy of you know, being a gamer and in control of a protagonist, but actually the dementia is a control in control of Sunita, not the player really.
Yes.
So we were sort of playing with those things, and we'd use jump cuts to sort of move them around the space and disconcert.
Yes, yeah. Fantastic. Virginia. Right, so tell me about moving to Sweden. we're jumping forward a little bit, but you go from making this acclaimed indie game to then joining one of the real big powerhouses of the industry, so Ubisoft Studio now, I think. Yeah, what took you there?
Yeah, so I applied for the job. I was still working on Before I Forget, and I was at a sort of writer's retreat room, like a one-day sort of game writer's event thing. And yeah, there were people from Ubisoft Massive there. I almost didn't go to the thing. So I said to the host, I was like, are you sure I should be at this thing? There are people from like Ubisoft there. It seems a bit serious. I was like, I haven't even got a game out yet. And he's like, you write games that makes you, you know, that gets you in the room. And once you're in the room, you're the same as everybody else. And he's like, yeah, so it's fine. Don't worry about it. So, and it was true. I was at the thing and they said, yeah, we're working on like a big Hollywood IP and we want writers. And then my now narrative director was like, but you have to be willing to move to Sweden. And I was just at a point in my life where me and my boyfriend of like 11 years or something had just split up, well, like a year or so ago, but I'd bought him out of the house. And, you know, so I sort of, when she said that, because I was just like, oh, that's nice for people that they might want this job. And then she said that and it just kind of like hit me like, I could totally move to Sweden. So he always wanted to move somewhere. And I also was like, I like our house and like, I like our friends. And because I'd moved around quite a lot as a kid, so I was more settled. But then this thing kind of like I had this realization. I was like, yeah, I could totally move to Sweden. I mean, I'm not going to, but I could because, you know, I'm like completely independent now and I don't need to ask anyone or worry about their job or something. You know, I'm like a free agent basically. And then I did apply for it, and then I got an interview, and then I got an on-site interview, and then they offered me the job, and then I was just like,
oh no, this is happening.
yeah
it was just a joke.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then I spoke to my my ex on the phone and I was like, yeah, so I think I'm moving to Sweden. And he just laughed. He's just like, what? And it's like, I know. So we're just like, how did that happen? It's the wrong way around.
How was it when you turned up? Did it feel like you'd made the right decision?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I spent like 6 years in Amsterdam when I was a kid. So yeah, it felt nice to be back in Europe again. It felt a little bit like the Netherlands, the kind of vibe of the city. And then, yeah, like Massive is just full of really nice people. It has this kind of college campus vibe. It reminded me of being at my international school in the Netherlands, actually, just like because it's, you know, full of people from all over the place and it's young and, you know, people were always having parties and we were always going clubbing and stuff like that. It was almost like being back at uni. It was kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, that was obviously pre-pandemic. Everyone's exhausted.
Yeah.
Nice. And I mean, something that you've written about a lot in your career was the lack of diversity, I guess, in the games industry, particularly in the UK, which has quite a poor representation, I would say, of black people. I think there was the UK Trade Association for the games industry found just 10% of the workforce in the UK in the video games industry are black, Asian, minority ethnic backgrounds. I'm imagining that might be similar in Sweden. I think it can be helpful maybe for people to understand what it's like walking into a room where you're the only person who looks like you.
Yeah, I guess in some ways you kind of get used to it, like because video games is such a white space that not the only time, but if you're working in a not toxic atmosphere, which, you know, fortunately I am, the times that you recognize that you're the only person in the room is when you're not. So I was in a VO recording session. It was majority black. And I was just like, oh my God, this is so cool. It was like the first time I'd been in a work environment because the actor was black, the audio engineer was black, and I'm black. And then it was only the director who was white. And it was just like, that's cool. So it depends who you're in a room with, you know, which room you've walked into.
Right, yeah.
And I guess sometimes, you know, you can have more emotional labor, you know, like if you're the only black person in the room and other people are just like sitting in their blind spots, you know, completely unaware, then you're the person that's always bringing up the representation question, or I don't know, like fighting for the candidate who has slightly less experience or has no AAA experience but has lots of talent or whatever it might be, all those sorts of things. And then I guess it's always like if it takes you longer to get a job or, you know, to find opportunities, you don't want to sit and think like, oh, is it because, you know, I have an Indian name, or is it because, you know, like, you know, on my CV, is it just like filtered out straight away? Which statistically I've read articles where, you know, that does happen, and some parents, you know, tell their kids to change their second name so that they get job opportunities. You know, you don't want to like move through the world like thinking that or feeling that, but sometimes you do have to wonder why.
Indeed. Why don't we come to your fifth and your final game then, Shella? Tell us about this one. It's from 2017. One of my favourite games of all time, I have to say. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, what remains of Edith Finch? It's probably a cliche for a narrative designer to have this on their perfect console, but it's a cliche for a good reason. It's just a really perfect game. Yeah, so it's a anthology game about, it has a sort of like Poe-esque vibe to it. So it's about a cursed family, the Finch family of curse, and each member of the family has died in a peculiar way, and the house is like the, so you are Edith Finch, who's returning to the family home, and you're the last of your family, and
she's like been given it in the will or something, and she has to go and, you know, sort it out,
yeah,
doesn't she?
Yeah, and each room is like a sort of memorial to the person who used to own it, who's dead now, and so you enter a room, you gain a new story in the anthology, and each character has completely different gameplay, and it's just this incredible journey through to Giant Sparrow, the developer. They're kind of preoccupied with storytelling and going inside stories. Quite often you'll like climb into books and the game is split into chapters and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they've got this sort of like real, I mean, you know, with me, the romantic child lost in books as a kid, you know, it's just like a perfect game developer in that respect. But yeah, it goes from, yeah, at one point it's you're on a swing in a first person, yeah, just like swinging as high as you can. Like some of the games are so joyful and poignant at the same time.
Yes,
it's just such a beautiful game.
Yeah. They're quite domestic scale as well, aren't they? Because there's one where you're in the bath, and
yes.
But like you say, it's sort of feels bigger than that, doesn't it? Even though you're in these quite small scenes, as it were.
Yeah, and it's also this huge metaphor for storytelling in video games. It's just incredible, like, you know, the history of story and narrative design in video games. It goes through, it has an isometric moment, and then it becomes like fully 3D. It's just like, it's incredible. And yeah, and it's kind of, I didn't think about it until I put this list together, but I think it's one of the last games that I reviewed. I reviewed it for The Guardian and I gave it a 5. And I think they were all
out
like,
of five, that yes, is, we should say.
Yes. The 5 out of 5.
Yeah, that was history has proven you correct with that call, I think.
Yeah.
What Remains of Edith Finch, a spectacular game.
It is.
Right, let's go through your console then. So we've got Beneath the Steel Sky, Tony Hawk's Skateboarding, City of Heroes, Virginia, and What Remains of Edith Finch. Wonderful. Cool, you got a lot there to work through across all sorts of different genres.
I know, yeah.
Okay, have you thought of a name for your console? We need a name to sell it with.
Oh, gosh,
did I not mention this? I'm sorry.
That's okay. A name.
Oh, gosh. You have to get your notebook out because I put you on the spot, sorry. So, yeah, what could we call your console and market it to the world?
Could you name? Gosh, yeah, because that's the thing. Like, everybody, when they announce a new console, and we're all like, that's a terrible name.
Yes. I remember when the Nintendo Wii was announced, that was just everyone laughed for like 2 days. And then suddenly it was like, oh, no, that's just what it's called.
Yeah, it was.
We're all okay. We're all okay with it now.
Yeah. So maybe Island or something, because I'm an island girl.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. The Islander.
Yeah.
All right, Michelle, just before I let you go, I want to ask one last question. So, you know, you're someone who is, I would say you're sort of interested in some taboo areas with your video games, certainly with your independent ones.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any areas that should be off limits when it comes to topics or subjects for video games to tackle? Or do you think we should be free to examine anything?
Interesting question. Yeah, I think, because, you know, there's always the are games art? You know, I don't know, would we level that question even at any other art form? So, yeah, I think my answer is, yeah, we should be free to explore everything in games because we want to explore the human experience, right? You know, that's what I want to do, at least, or at least engage with the human experience, even if you're not interested in exploring it explicitly.
Yeah.
To do that, we need to have access to everything to explore.
I really like what you said at the beginning, actually, about how, you know, even if you're examining a traumatic period of history, even it's not constant trauma for the people within that. There's still moments of human connection and levity and hope and all of that stuff. Which I think is a good rule, isn't it, to say?
Yeah, it is about finding, I have done a talk on, you know, like how to make games with this sort of a respect for what your game is about, to go beyond the, oh, that's kind of cool, initial curiosity about something, and to sort of unpack why you're telling that story. are you the right person to be telling that story? Approach it with some sense of responsibility for the story or the topic.
Yes, indeed. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for being so open and sharing your story and everything. And thank you for your work as well, which we all appreciate. And we're super looking forward to your Windrush Tales game as well.
Oh, so, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much to my guest, Shella Ramanan. What a lovely person Shella is, and so enjoyed hearing her perspective on games, how she got into this industry, quite an unusual route, but just wonderful to hear her story there. And I think as well, that sort of slightly left field perspective and route into games as a novelistic literary person deciding to tell stories in this particular area has led to some interesting work, particularly with Threefold Games. That is Shella and her partner there, development partner Claire Morwood, and the two of them made Before I Forget, the game about living with a degenerative brain condition. And then, of course, the Tales of Windrush game that is coming at some point. You can, in fact, I believe, play a bit of Windrush Tales, or at least see some of the development materials in the British Library. I know this because I have a guest coming on from the British Library who talks about some of the exhibitions they have there at the moment, some of the video game related exhibitions, and they mention the Tales of Windrush game. So I'll leave you to listen to that episode as and when it comes out. But if you are in London in the next few days and weeks, then you can pop by the British Library and see a bit of what Shella has been up to. In terms of the Avatar game, again, I'm not quite sure if that has a release date yet, but I imagine that'll be make a big splash as and when that arrives as well. That studio has produced some great work, and it's wonderful to know that the game will have Shella's voice and perspective as part of the stories it is attempting to tell. Thank you for listening this far into the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, why not leave us a little review? You can do so on iTunes, the podcast app, or on Spotify. I think you can just tap the little star rating button. It all helps people to find the podcast. If you want a bit more My Perfect Console content, then please do head to www.patreon.com/myperfectconsole. You can become a supporter for just $5 or £4.50 a month, I think it is. You'll get all sorts of benefits. You get your episodes early and ad-free, of course, but you also get information on the guests that are coming up monthly. You get voting rights in the My Perfect Console knockout competition coming later in the year. Some bonus episode content as well. So lots of things that you can read more about at that address. And of course, becoming a supporter just does help keep the keep it all happening, I guess. Right, so I think that's probably enough from me this week. It's lovely to have you along for the ride. If you do want to write to me with any thoughts or comments or suggestions, then it's myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Okay, I will be back again next week with a new guest with their five games and one more perfect console. Till then, have a great week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.